ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. If vulnerability is the birthplace of innovation, then over the last few years, media and entertainment has provided fertile ground for those brave enough to do what hasn't already been done. Over the past 7 years, Daniel Cheatham has tilled that soil. He's focused on innovation and built, from the ground up, a technology and innovation offering at Happy Finish, a creative production company dedicated to excellence in immersive storytelling. His team of engineers, scientists, storytellers, and artists have made Happy Finish known as world leaders in the creation of immersive experiences. Daniel continually pushes for innovation through hands-on practice and craftsmanship across all creative mediums, which is why he's with us today, speaking about innovation and how to harness AI, AR, VR, and MR to better connect and engage with consumers. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Prior to COVID-19, the entertainment and marketing industries were already going through tectonic changes. Subsequently, we've seen certain trends accelerate and other parts of the economy grind to a standstill. Can you give us the elevator ride summary for where pre-COVID innovation services were? Sort of before everything hit, where were we standing?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, maybe maybe a touch of context. I've been working in the immersive technology and creative technology space for about 10 years now. So have sort of been on a roller coaster of the embryonic rise of technologies like VR, virtual reality, augmented reality, and mixed reality, seeing that adoption increase over the past 5 or so years, but not increase at the pace at which some market analysts would have us believe. However, working in the brand marketing and brand funded space, we have seen many brands who would normally market themselves in a very traditional way adopt these technologies as a way in which to differentiate themselves and create new experiences for their customers or their potential customers. So adoption of new technologies has been happening and has been happening at a growing, exponentially growing pace.
Has it been that hockey stick kind of growth? Has it been that steep?
I'm always a little bit nervous of the hockey stick graphs. Gartner publish every year Gartner publish a hype cycle, which measures the rise, the peak to the peak of expected impact of a particular technology. That cycle often then tails off into what Gartner refer to the trough of disillusionment around a particular technology or the promise of that technology, and then scales back up towards a path of enlightenment towards ubiquitous adoption of that technology. So those hockey stick curves, I'm often nervous that that is the first upward trend on a cycle, and that one might witness a plateau and then a drop off of interest in a certain technology until really the technology grows to a point to fulfill what people believe the promise of that technology is, if that makes sense. So
yes.
I wouldn't say it's hockey stick. I would like to say it's more of a gradual adoption based on the utility that the technologies can offer.
So at the point where, if we're looking at pre-COVID, you were getting a steady stream of RFPs. Were there particular trends that were happening
that you could say this is where the sweet spot for growth is likely to be, or where you anticipated it would be?
Yeah, I mean, I think we could all, or many of us could see it coming, particularly in the virtual reality space and the immersive space, where a handful of years ago, 2016, was 360 video content was a pretty big deal. Lots of the big platforms, the Facebook, YouTubes of this world, started supporting 360 video as a medium with which people could engage. We were doing a lot of that stuff. It was on trend from a PR perspective to do something new, to do a world first. I mean, I get many briefs that have please create a world's first in them. But for sure, the last couple of years, direction of travel has been away from the more linear type of immersive content and towards working in game engine. So working with optimized CGI assets that allow us to create truly interactive immersive experiences. So that direction of travel, working with engine, likes of Unreal and Unity, was definitely already happening. What's also been happening is the fidelity and quality of experience and from an aesthetic perspective that we can create in those real-time game engines has improved exponentially over the last 2 or 3 years, and we see that trend continuing. So it was pretty clear that the experiences we would be creating would be generated in real-time engine, in game engine, and would require development skills and CGI skills.
Okay, so now we're in COVID-19, and the world is in this weird place. Until there is a widely distributed vaccine, old world normal is a long way off. So, two questions. Generally speaking, did you see any of these trends accelerate? I mean, you're somewhat limited by where the tech actually is, what it is possible to do with these game engines. And second, in chaos, there's opportunity. And so where are you seeing the most need and opportunity emerge where maybe it wasn't before?
So to pick up on the first question as to whether the current situation in relation to COVID-19 has been somewhat of a catalyst around the speed up of adoption of new technologies, I can say absolutely yes, that has been the case. What we're finding is that brands and clients who traditionally may have been wary of taking a new route in terms of trying new technology, finding new ways to engage with customers, potential customers, to market themselves, are now way more willing to explore these technologies because of the constraints that COVID-19 place on us, particularly those brands, those clients that are previously heavily reliant on bricks and mortar, on retail space, on stores, from an enterprise level, who have been reliant on physical products to sell through to retail partners, you know, relying on samples coming from Asia. That has all been really challenged with the current situation. And so our ability to create digital twins of products, of store environments, of sales environments, seems to be more relevant than ever.
When you say a digital twin of a product and getting samples from Asia, is that like clothing samples that I could review? What kind of products are we talking about? And is this for internal purposes, or is, you know, the business to business application, or is this a business to consumer application?
Yeah, I can only really talk to sort of our experiences there, but the term digital twin is being used very broadly at the moment from, I know some businesses here in the UK and in Europe, who are engaged in creating digital twins of whole cities, everything from the buildings and the visible above ground environment to the subterranean networks of sewage and power supplies, complete digital twins of cities. That's not what I'm referring to. I'm from where we work, space we work. It's really around digital twinning physical products that are normally bought based on their aesthetic. So fashion products, sneakers, homewares, things that people make a purchase decision on based on how they look and how they feel. And that's the area that we're finding real success in, is the ability to be able to create those photorealistic assets that are optimized to be used in real time, which allows them to be used in VR, in augmented reality, in web-based experiences, and be able to show them to a distributed audience, as opposed to that audience having to come to a physical space, a showroom, to check out those products. So it's
a consumer-facing...
Currently, most of our work's happening at a sort of enterprise level there. Okay. So the sell through to retail partners.
Right.
However, those same assets, once we've created them, clearly can then go further upstream or downstream, depending on where you sit, to consumer, to become part of the marketing material. I mean, if we think of a sneaker, for example, that sneaker that we have created from a design drawing to be photorealistic can be used to encourage retail partners to make purchase decisions on what they will stock, but also can that same virtual asset can be used in a promotional film, a piece of advertising around that product to the end consumer. So it's this idea of build once, use many is very relevant.
Right. So art of innovation has to be a comfort with failure, and failing fast, and enabling failure, learning from failure. A culture of innovation requires a comfortable and productive relationship with failure. Can you talk about how your team thinks about failure, and if you have any cultural guidelines or thoughts to share? I think some people would appreciate some real honesty, because there's a lot of lip service paid to fail fast, but in practice, it's hard to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to talk about failing upwards when you're building your own product and you have a long runway to do so. We have a reputation for innovative work and doing new things and trying new things. But we have to do that in the constraints of understanding that very often there's a budget and always there's a deadline for delivering. So you're right to point out it's a challenging juggling act to ensure that you're continuing to foster and push for innovation whilst equally not risking failure from an external client perspective, because that's ultimately a bad look for a business like ours. We want to be able to deliver something, and something that's going to be really powerful and work. So I mean, at an internal level with our development team, our creative teams, we all push each other to find a new innovation. One of the things that we look at, and we view this as innovation, and I truly believe it is, it's not necessarily creating something new from the ground up every time. It's looking at what's happening in a different field, a different area, for example, gaming. Thinking about, okay, if we take that technique, if we take what's happening there, we apply it to a new sector, a new realm, a new challenge, do we find a new way of tackling that problem? Which mitigates some of the risks of having to hand roll innovation every time. We're applying innovations that are happening elsewhere to new things. And so in many ways, we sort of mitigate by by ripping off innovation from other sectors and applying it to new ones.
Right, which sort of leads me to another thing and goes back to one of the things you mentioned earlier is it, when I had an agency, clients would sometimes say they wanted something that nobody had ever done before and they wanted to reinvent XYZ thing. But when we showed them options, their reaction to the most innovative original work was often, oh, I like it, but nobody's ever done that. When your clients come to you and they want worlds first, do they really want worlds first?
Yeah, I think generally they do. I sort of think it's our job. If we really want to push innovation, it's our job to make clients uncomfortable. It comes down, a pretty critical question. It comes down to the risk the individual client is willing to take around it, because it's a personal risk. It's a risk of being seen to be using a budget in something that ultimately doesn't transpire and deliver against the ROI that they're looking for, and that's an individual's risk.
Right. Well, that goes to a sort of follow-on question, which is how important is the bravery of your clients? And this is a factor that's outside of your control. So how do you manage the risk averse?
Mm.
What are the KPIs and case studies that you use to help them get there?
Yeah, that's also a very good question. It's a very probing question because in many ways, we're potentially not the right supplier for the risk averse, which is not to scare off all those risk averse people who might be interested in getting in touch. but if you want the mundane, if you want the normal, then there are plenty of people out there who can replicate that and offer that. The reason we keep our staff engaged and our talent engaged is because we are willing to press the buttons other people aren't willing to press and ask those questions about, you know, this is news, it has some risk involved, but it's a risk potentially worth taking if you want to, one, stand out from the crowd, and two, from a personal perspective, we was talking to you before, elevate your career, be seen as somebody who's willing to take that risk. And when it pays off, it can really pay off dividends. So I guess the answer is we ultimately thrive off having clients who want to make their career through taking risk.
Right. So there's a certain amount of self-selection that goes on in terms of the people who knock on the door, and then you help bring them over the finish line, but you're not getting the real nervous Nellies, it sounds like.
We get the nervous Nellies.
You do? Definitely. Well, so yeah, okay, yeah. If I'm the nervous Nelly, do you do something more mundane for me, or do you manage to convince me to jump off the cliff?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we try our best to manage to get you to jump off the cliff with us, not on your own.
There you go.
And we're in it together, and we're very open about our processes. I mean one of the things we do really early on when we're ideating around new innovative ideas is we work through what if sessions, and it's a tried and tested approach to get buy-in from everyone around the table, is rather than us hit upon one idea that we think nails a brief, we bounce a handful of one-page ideas together. We maybe put five or six of them forward, and we sit around the table with client, with stakeholders, and we discuss them all. And we talk about the merits or the problems of each, which ones would never work, which ones might work. And we engage the clients in the development process of the creative with us. So they feel involved, you know.
How does that work in terms of budget? One of the things I have seen happen is they have a pot of money and they want all of that money to show up on the screen, to show up in the execution. But clearly there's a very critical development phase, which in order for things to work well in the execution phase, you really have to spend the time So how much, if you're carving up a pot of money, how much, what percentage should people be thinking about is spent towards developing the idea? And how much, yeah, of the, how much of the schedule is spent during this creative exploration?
Yeah, well, I mean, we have a rule of thumb around that, that of the 100% that we have to play with, 100% of budget sort of ultimately equates to 100% of time or resource. 20 to 30% of that is in the creative development and scoping. 50% is actually in production proper, in making. And then the remaining 20 to 30% is in testing, final iteration, and deployment. You know, and it's easy to forget or to minimize the last bit, the testing and iteration, the finesse, but it is often the most important bit. I think that actually the bumpers either end, the 20, 30% upfront in really pushing and pulling that idea around, testing it out, proxy tests and working prototypes to get to something you're confident that when you go into the production of is right, you've nailed it. And then the other, at the other end of the production, the testing and the final iteration, the finesse, they are hugely important components. If the expectation is everything's going to go straight all into production, everything's going to be the final thing on the table, well, unfortunately, that's not the case. We would be remiss if we were doing stuff that had been done time and time again, tried and tested, then yeah, maybe. But in the space we work in, trying to push technology for creative output, yeah, that split 20 to 30% up front of pushing and pulling on your idea and technically scoping it out, hugely important, hugely important. You set up to fail if you don't do that.
Right. And so this conversation, this sort of 2030, 50, 2030, you have that conversation. So it's very explicit with your clients so that they really understand and you get it there. And do you have to remind them about it as they go?
It's in our deck. It's in our proposal deck. When we initially start talking to a client, we show it as part of our process. Okay. So it's clear. And we actually break out our budgets in that way as well. And our scopes of work, everything is broken down to show the importance of that upfront work.
It's great that you're able to get them to really hold that thought in their mind. A lot of times people see a deck, but they don't internalize what that caveat, description, reminder means.
Commercially, Gabriella, it's also important for us to do that, to be clear, because we tend to work, and I think much of the marketing and communications world from an agency to supplier perspective is moving in this direction. We tend to work on a project by project commission with right. clients, rather than having those multi-year agency of record retainers. We have some of those as well. But when we're working project by project, what we really can ill afford to do is completely map out every single granular detail of production before we get sign off on a budget. So we need our clients to work in partnership with us to understand that, to trust us that we will get to the results off the back of our heritage, our case studies, meeting our team, the conversations we have ahead of sign off. That developing out the granular detail and the scope has to form part of the project for us.
It makes total sense to me. The thing that I'm curious about, because you've obviously been in operation for a while, and if you do have repeat clients, which I'm sure you do, if you don't find that you periodically are getting telephone calls from the sourcing department, and they're sort of like the horse head in the bed call, you know, where they're like, we're here to help you. And by help you, we mean figure out how we can pay you net 90 and, you know, fix you into the widget box. Do you get those kinds of calls? I mean, a lot of creative agencies are starting to, as brands are looking to contain and manage costs, their creative partners are falling under the control of the sourcing and procurement number crunchers. Do you, and that runs counter to a project scope cost fixed bid situation.
Yeah.
Have you run into that or not yet?
Yeah, we have. And I have numerous times in my career. I've been lucky enough to play at the sort of innovation end of creative technology for a number of years now. And we're sort of at the cusp of being able to be, we can't be categorized in many ways by procurement because of what we do is not mainstream enough.
Right. So as long as you stay there, you're good.
Yeah. But then there's a question of being able to scale and when adoption does happen, which is happening with augmented reality right now, and it's becoming something which is not just a, I've read something in Campaign magazine or an article somewhere, so I feel like I need to do an AR thing. It's like AR is going to be a mainstay of how we bring our product to market to our consumers for the foreseeable future. Then it starts to become, I guess, a more commoditized piece that then certainly gets the eyes of procurement teams on us. But that's fine as well, because once it becomes part of the marketing mix, the marketing and communications budget, there's a line item for it. It means it's at a certain scale. That means we can scale with that. If we're working with a global product brand, for example, and we need to create thousands of SKUs of products in CG every year, then it's reasonable to expect that we'll be able to somehow bring efficiencies to that process because we're doing it time and time again.
Right. So presumably you're not reinventing the wheel. Presumably that 20-30% creative development and scope you've actually worked through and now you're scaling it.
Yeah. And that's when it sort of moves from being at the embryonic innovation end of the spectrum into something which is a little bit more mainstream. And I guess there is a... there's an element of that for individuals like me who enjoy working at the, I guess, the riskier end of the technology and content spectrum, that as soon as it starts becoming mainstream, it stops being risky and it stops having maybe the same appeal as the next interesting technique that you can apply to create communications that engage humans in different interesting ways. So there's it's a bit of a tightrope you can walk there. There's the commercial motivation and then there's the personal motivation of wanting to always do new stuff. Running a business and having a number of employees and shareholders, you wrestle with making sure that you're doing right by all of those individuals by scaling the business in the direction that it needs to go. But equally, from a personal perspective and to attract the talent that will take you to that next generation, you still need to be playing, I feel, in the test and learn space, in the fail upwards space. So I think the best dynamic one can have is to have maybe like a creme brulee approach, where you have the custard layer that is your more commoditized offering that you can talk to procurement about, you can scale, but you have your crispy, delicious, crusty layer, which is your shining star innovation led work as well, because the risk of the project to project innovation work is that sometimes you may go a period without getting a big project. And that's challenging for any business to be able to deal with ups and downs revenue profile. So you want to build a recurring revenue profile, but also have the exciting, shiny stuff on the top. If that makes sense. This is a terrible analogy, but
total,
I think hopefully it lands.
It makes total sense. And actually, it segues very nicely into our wrapping up question, which is looking ahead, what's up next for you? And let's talk about not the custard layer, but the crispy fun layer. What's the crispy fun layer that's on deck? What are you looking forward to?
Yeah, I mean, the things that are really, really exciting right now, personally, and I think that are here to stay, are really around how we're using machine learning to bring a new dimension to how we create content and create experiences for humans. How we can leverage these techniques to scale what we do, but also how we can ensure that we're creating more relevant content for end users. So the ability for us to use machines to understand emotionally how people respond to content, to be able to dynamically adapt that content in real time, I think is you get into a sort of slightly potentially scary world where that could be used for the wrong messaging and the wrong types of communication, but also a very exciting world where, you know, we get to a space where we can consider being able to create very discrete interactions for individuals based on their very personal preferences and being able to adapt that in real time. So machine learning, AI, and how we leverage those tools in the creation of next generation experiences for me is like super exciting space.
Yeah, I really agree. I think that's where the interesting innovation and things are gonna happen. Thank you so much for your time. It's really been great.
Thanks again for having me.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking my production team at Up Next, my friend Rob Naughton, the voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, all of you, the members of our audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next time, right here on Up Next.